Welcome to the Martian Driving Podcast number 3, and I said it wouldn't last. My name's Terry Frost, and this time around, as last time, I've got a guest, Paul Poulton. How you doing, Paul?
Hello. Doing well.
That's good. So any good genre stuff you've been watching lately? Bad genre stuff?
Well, other than what we're going to discuss later, mostly TV stuff at the moment.
Anything good?
Been watching the Continuum series.
Yeah, I watch Continuum. I'm still not sure about it. I'm a bit up about it. A bit iffy.
Yeah, I think it's one of those. It's a little bit formulaic. Some of the ideas are quite interesting, but I'm still sort of I don't know.
Yeah, I'm kind of. I don't think I'll get any more episodes of it unless somebody tells me it's having a big turnaround.
Off next week to see Brave with my brother's offspring. So. Look to that one.
Get a bit of Pixar happening.
Yeah.
Yeah, what have I seen? I saw In Time, the Andrew Niccol movie with Justin Timberlake and Amanda Seyfried in it. And it's kind of okay, but I don't think it's as good as some of his earlier stuff like Gattaca and things like that.
Mm.
I saw that on illegal download, and I'm unashamedly going to say that because
Uncle Torrens.
Uncle Torrens, yeah, absolutely. And what else did I say? I saw one other thing that I enjoyed. Let me have a look at my torrent file, and that will tell me what it was. It's just kill some time here. Let me have a look. Okay, that's the wrong one I've just opened there. This is wonderful, wonderful podcasting, me doing this, but we'll get there. I did try to watch The Star Lost. Remember the old Harlan Ellison TV series from 1973 that he took his name off because it was shit?
Vaguely.
Yeah, it's set on an enormous space station with habitats in it and everything's gone wrong.
Yeah,
it's shit.
Yeah.
So that's basically my answer to that. It's not very good at all. There's no dramatic pacing to it. I mean, I don't mind the fact that they had to go cheap on the budget and all that kind of other stuff because that's just the nature of the business at times.
Yeah.
But there's no dramatic pacing to anything at all. It's a really freaky piece of work because of that. It really is, what the fuck were they thinking, television? So I'm just trying to find that other movie that I watched that I enjoyed, but I can't seem to find it here. I have been trying to find some French science fiction too. I'm going to go through a phase, I think, of watching some French science fiction movies because they're kind of cool and kind of different. And so I'm slowly getting a little bit of a collection of those to watch.
Yeah. I recently rewatched... The Golden Child.
Is that the one with Eddie Murphy?
Yeah.
Ooh. I tried to watch that one.
Actually, it wasn't that bad. I mainly dug it up going through the Game of Thrones thing, as I think just about everybody else has, and was talking about Charles Dance. And I said that came to me as the first movie that I remember seeing him in. So I sort of went, all right, I've got to dig it up. And it's like, it's 30 years ago and the guy doesn't look like he's aged a bit, so.
Yeah, they have certain operations they give you for that sort of thing.
And I dug up a copy of that Passport to Pimlico, which
I'd
never heard of before I saw your the other podcast. So I went, I have to dig this up. So, yeah.
Mm. It's great, isn't it? It's good fun. And it's very much of its time, which makes it even more interesting, yeah. But, anything else I've been watching? I'm just trying to look through it. I did see a really bad sci-fi channel movie called Arachnoquake with giant spiders in Louisiana in it. And, it had giant spiders. It's the usual kind of pap they put out once a week from sci-fi channel. But I think Sal's going to enjoy it when I give her the copy to watch on her machine.
I remember watching the Arachnophobia movie many, many years ago. With I think two of the five people that were watching it were severe arachnophobes, so that was quite fun.
Yeah, I've got arachnophobes at work. I've got a metal spider that's made out of nuts and bolts and things that sits on the desk. And there are people that are so arachnophobic they get scared of that, which is a bit weird. But I never really had a fear of spiders. I won't let them go near me if I can help it. But that's purely a safety measure.
Yeah.
Okay, so now we're going to do news from Mars.
Here's the breaking news from the planet Mars.
We actually have some weird Martian news. You're going to like this, Paul. Really, really going to like this, mate. A Dutch startup company by the name of Mars One says it will establish a colony on Mars by 2023. And they're going to do it as a reality TV show.
Okay.
Yep. A Nobel Prize winning physicist, and this is the guy's name, Dr. Gerard de Hooft, apostrophe T, not space, capital H-O-O-F-T, Gerard de Hooft. He's a mission ambassador for the privately funded venture company. So basically what they're going to do is take a whole bunch of people there and stream it back to Earth as a reality TV show and leave them there. Now, either it's the biggest... Yeah, it's the biggest scam in the world. But, they actually have serious plans and they've got little bit of an...
Part of me is quite excited of the possibility of being able to ship some of these reality TV contestants off to another planet and leave them there. That'd be great.
Well, I think they should should get all the wankers, and, people like the people on Fox News and Andrew Bolt here in Australia. And what we should do is we should tell Gina Rinehart, the richest woman in the world, the Australian mining magnate, that they have minerals on Mars.
Apparently she's lost that title.
Who's the richest woman in the world now? Lady Gaga.
No, there's a Chinese woman who's just pipped her at the post last week or something like that.
Yeah, that's because she's got she's got Fairfax shares. No, but apparently they're going to do it. They've got all these nice little graphics and things about it. And, I kind of like the idea of saying, okay, we're going to stick a whole bunch of really boring people in a rocket, launch them to Mars, and then film what happens. The only problem is that if the ratings fail, do they turn off the oxygen?
Well, I was saying, you get voted out of the house and you're in deep shit.
Yeah, you're suddenly kind of like Arnie when they – jumps out the window in Total Recall. And which they're remaking, by the way. They got one with, Colin Farrell.
I've heard there's a new trailer out for it that has the infamous triple boobs.
Yeah, they got a triple boob hooker, but they're setting it on Earth because of the Hollywood voodoo. The Hollywood voodoo says any movie that you make set on Mars is a failure. Everyone forgets Total Recall.
I still remember there was a TV version of Bradbury's Martian Chronicles that I thought was quite good. But
try rewatching it again. I rewatched the first of the three parts of that. About a month and a half ago.
That is coloured by the distance of time. So yeah, I don't know what it'd stand up to like today.
It doesn't hold up well. There are things from that time that hold up really well, and that's what we talk about in this podcast. But they kind of really screw the pooch on that, and it's very – there's kind of stiltedness that comes into certain works when they're not really sure of their source material, not really sure of their script, and they don't have too much faith in the genre.
Yeah.
And I think that's – Star-Lost being another example, but I think that's something that – I find interesting too. There are other ones, the 4D Man that we're going to talk about today. I haven't mentioned the movies we're going to talk about yet. We're doing the 4D Man from 1959, and we're doing Idiocracy from 2006, which is kind of loosely and illicitly based on Sam Kornbluth's 1951 short story, The Marching Morons. So we've got back to literary science fiction somehow in this podcast. But let's wrap up the thing about Mars. Who would you send on a reality TV show to Mars?
Sorry, say that one again. You just went fuzzy.
Who would you send on a reality TV trip to Mars?
Could we send Laura Bingle there?
Laura
Bingle. I think if it's one of those things, I remember some of the the live webcam stuff when NASA used to broadcast things from the space station and when they were doing shuttle missions and things like that. And some of that was quite interesting because, it was all the scientists were learning how things worked with zero G. And, so it was new for them just as much as it was new for us. So, I think if they do that, but as far as, if you're just doing it as a reality show, the list is so long.
Well, that's it, and I kind of like the space shuttle ones because basically It's a whole bunch of astronauts that they send up there for cost millions of dollars, and they kind of blow bubbles and play with their food.
There was a picture I saw recently of, and I'm assuming it was taken on the space station, of there's an air bubble trapped inside a water drop. That's they're both suspended in zero G, obviously, and so this sort of bubble within a bubble, and you know, it's not something that you'd be able to replicate here.
Not easily, no. But I think that'd be a great way to make ice creams. You could find a way to do that and kind of freeze the stuff, make ice creams and other stuff, and then send them back down again when you've got different flavors layered in them.
I'm sure if you bump the price up on that sort of, you know, made in space or whatever, you'd still get people that would pay the premium for it.
Yeah, I had an idea after the moon landings when I was a kid. I had this great idea that what they should do is bring back a whole bunch of rocks, cut them up, and sell key rings for $10 each.
Yeah, well, it's, I mean, you can still – well, supposedly you can still buy moon rocks, but how authentic they are, I have no idea.
Yeah, you'd have to go with the provenance for those ones. But anyway, that's about it for Mars. I hope the reality TV thing really doesn't happen, because I'd like it to be the first people on Mars. You want them to be heroic in some ways.
Yeah.
You know, I think they should have, like, all different races, all different colours, more the atheists than religious people, and maybe a gay couple or a lesbian couple or a transgendered people in there, and kind of just send a strong signal to the whole fucking planet that we're a diverse place, and then when we go out there, we're going to take our diversity with us.
Yeah, I hope we don't end up with something like, you know, Jersey Shore on Mars or something that it just...
Ugh. Yeah, I think it's a good way to kind of advertise space travel, putting out this blurb saying you've got to do a reality TV show on Mars. But I'm not sure how much follow-through it's got.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're going to take a break now, and when we get back, we're going to talk about The 4D Man, starring Robert Lansing and Lee Merriweather from 1959.
A man, an idea, the equipment, a place to work in secret. All the ingredients are here. He attacks the job of trying to pass a wooden dowel through a steel block with the confidence of a man who knows it can be done. Maybe it will work tonight. It has failed many times before, but driven by an obsession that it can be done, he is unconcerned with failures of the past or dangers of the future. His only interest is to prove his theory. More power, more risk. Now it's steel against steel. Two objects can occupy the same space at the same time under proper conditions. He knows his theory is sound. It's all down on paper, a few precious pages that represent years of research and experimentation. But he doesn't know that his obsession will transform a man into a monster, a man whose life will be changed as he crosses the threshold into the fourth dimension.
Okay, and we're back, and Paul and I are going to look at the second movie made by the producer of The Blob, which is 1959's The 4D Man, which had another name when it was re-released in the UK later, in America later on. I'm just trying to find what that is. It is Master of Terror was the name they gave it when they re-released it. So do you want to do a synopsis or you want me to?
You can do that, yeah.
Okay, I'm going to paraphrase from Wikipedia. That's always a good start. Brilliant but irresponsible scientist Tony Nelson, played by James Congdon, develops an amplifier that allows any object to achieve a four-dimensional state. While in this state, the object can pass freely through any other object. Unemployed after burning through a college lab, Tony seeks out his brother Scott, a research worker on a material called carbonite that is so dense as to be impenetrable. And he gets Scott to help him with the experiments. Scott's girlfriend, played by Lee Merriweather, falls in love with Tony, and Tony's upset because this will be the second time that he's grabbed his brother's girlfriend. And his brother gets pissed off with this whole triangle thing, and grabs the amplifier that Tony has created, and Scott actually learns how to move himself into a 4D state and to move through other objects. But there is a big downside. That pretty much covered?
Yeah.
Yep. So Robert Lansing plays Scott.
We're going to minimize the spoilers.
Oh, well, we can kind of hint at them. Yeah. Basically, he sucks the energy out of other people. We can say that much.
Yeah.
To survive. It's a little bit like The Indestructible Man. It harks back to a couple of earlier films. It's very much kind of like a second tier Universal.
It's got a certain formula to it. So the whole 4D thing, I'm wondering whether that was to sort of try and cash in on what was fairly new at that stage was the 3D movies that were everywhere. Because I'm going, you know, prior to having watched this, I didn't know what the movie was about. So I'm thinking, 4D man, okay, someone who's able to move through time or something like that. And no, nothing to do with that. So
no, he just moves through other objects and really causes a lot of trouble. I mean, he picks up a girl, turns her into an old lady who dies because he ages people when he touches them, which is not inconsistent with, I think, The Indestructible Man, which was an old Lon Chaney Jr. one. I kind of like the film. There are a few things about it that I do like. I like the fact that they established the characters before they established the horror. Even though they do it a little bit cack-handed, they're trying to get you to kind of like all three characters in a way. Though Robert Lansing plays it a little bit taciturn. And if he had made it a tiny bit lighter at that stage of things, he might have been better off with it. I didn't mind the special effects in here. What did you think of them?
Certainly, you know, for their time, they're quite good. Yeah, I they kept it. I think there's a couple of things with practical effect shots that didn't look like they were, you know, oh my god, we have to show this guy's hand moving through a whatever. And they were quite well done, I thought. You know, the change from perspective between the various bits. You're not sort of sitting there going, oh, yes, I'm watching a fake practical shot.
No, and there were bits like he put his hand through a window to grab something out of a jewelry store window back in the days when jewelry stores actually had good stuff in the windows overnight. There's another bit where he's got his hand and a pencil stuck in a metal block. And I thought that was done really well because you could tell the circulation was being lost from the fingers. The fingers were turning white and things like that, which might have been the start of this phenomenon where he sucks the energy out of other things. But there is the physical acting that Robert Lansing does in this film is really quite intense. He does a good job there. I don't think his dialogue in that part where he strengthened that part of his career. But I really think the kind of physicality of who he was and what he was doing, really, he paid that really well.
Yeah. And I think, you know, as you said before, when they've established the character, he's coming off as a bit of a workaholic sort of bloke, and he moves into the manic side quite believably, I think.
Yeah, I think he may have been a bit of a method actor. He's got that kind of intensity that the method guys brought to things. They all had to be kind of Brando come James Dean-y in their own ways. There are a lot of actors. Richard Bradford, who was in that TV series Man for a Suitcase, is the ultimate version of that, where he basically tried to play Marlon Brando all the way through his career. But Lansing does a pretty good job here. He had a fairly long career too. He died fairly early, but he was a stalwart on TV. People in the genre world might remember him from playing Gary Seven in an episode of Star Trek: Assignment Earth, which was going to be a spin-off TV series.
It was supposed to be a backdoor pilot for another one. Yeah,
which is a bit of a shame.
And I can certainly see, you know, this was Lee Merriweather's first movie, and I can certainly see where, you know, after seeing that, the producers and directors are going, right, yes, we want more of that. Thank you.
Yeah, well, she was Miss America in 1955, about 4 years before this movie.
Oh, okay.
So she's kind of parlayed that into a fairly long TV career. People remember her as Catwoman in the movie version of the Batman TV series in 1966. I don't think she was as good as Eartha Kitt or Julie Newmar, but I think she held her own in some ways.
Yeah.
And she did a lot of episodic TV and things like that all the way through those kind of 60s and 70s. She was in the Time Tunnel as well, the Irwin Allen piece of shit from 1967,
68. they had their charm.
Yes, but unfortunately it was about 10 seconds long. But So
what did you think of the music in this one? I found it disconcerting.
I thought it was a pretty cool jazz score, really.
Oh, I mean, I think the music of itself, you know, really nice. Lots of brassy, you know, happening stuff. But it didn't work with the movie for me. You know, you're supposed to be getting these intense, dramatic things, and we're starting to get the big, you know, high-kicking trumpets in the background. So what are you doing? Bugger off.
Yeah, I think it's kind of our expectations a little bit too. I did think through that. I kind of got better at liking it in the movie context than where I was into the movie. I think what it is for this kind of movie, we expect kind of traditional orchestrations. You need theremins and strings and all those kind of eerie things to heighten the scariness of it.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah, to a certain extent, yeah, that's a more modern thing. But
But I think it's a good score. I think it's a really solid jazz score by a guy called Ralph Carmichael. I'm not sure how well it was applied to the movie. There are bits of it where you think, no, they should have gone something a bit lighter.
Mm.
Even just you know, somebody with a snare drum or something like that in the background to build the tension,
yeah,
rather than the full-on jazz score. But this isn't a large-budget movie. They didn't really have the luxury to nuance the score as much. But I like the fact that they tried something contemporary rather than going with the cliches of the genre and running with that jazz score. So if you want to listen to the score, the whole movie I put up on the Facebook page. I'm going to put onto the Martian Drive-In blog page too, which is marsdrivein.blogspot.com. It's up on YouTube in its entirety. It's not a bad print. I believe you saw a pretty shit print with your one, Paul.
Yeah, the version I had, I don't know, I had some wobble through the projection. So, not the best copy I had.
I think I'll set you up with a decent copy. Oh, no, the one on YouTube should be the one that solves that problem anyway. But they actually had an Academy Award-nominated actor in the movie as well.
Okay.
Robert Strauss, who played the kind of slightly older and a bit plagiaristic scientist.
The head of the research company.
No, not the one playing the head of the research company. The other guy who stole his research.
Oh, right. Yes.
Kind of heavy set actor, heavy eyebrows and things. He was nominated for an Oscar in 1953 in Starlight 17 for playing a guy called Animal, which he'd also played on Broadway. He was known as a Broadway actor as well. He did kind of broad, slightly comic roles on Broadway for a time. And I remember his second last movie because it was one of the first R-rated movies I ever saw. He did a R-rated movie called Dagmar's Hot Pants in the 1970s, second last movie he made before he died. And he looks a bit fish out of water in that one too, because he didn't really have the kind of character traits for a scientist. He had a deep, gravelly voice and he was burly, and I don't think he put across the scientific method very well in this one.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, I really do like this film a lot. The things I like about it, I do like the fact they tried the new score. I like the fact they tried to establish the characters. And you don't actually get to the horror part until almost halfway through the film, which is a really bold choice. I think they might have done that as well in the producer's previous movie. His name's Jack H. Harris. In The Blob, they established the characters, Steve McQueen's guy and the cops, and the juvenile delinquents around them, and that before the horror came.
As the story was progressing, I had originally thought that the person that was going to become the monster was going to be the younger, you know, unemployed brother and all that sort of stuff. I thought, we'll go with the here's the layabout unemployed one. We'll go with the morality tale for that. And it didn't go where I was expecting.
Well, yeah, because one of the things they state is you've got to have a kind of mental focus and an intensity to do this 4D thing. It's not just purely a physiological phenomenon. You've got to have a bit of will towards it. And I think having the kind of taciturn brother do it was consistent with that, and it was the rationale for it being him rather than the younger guy played by James Congdon.
Although I did when they first introduced Cognate's character, I did have a bit of a double take.
Why?
Tony Nelson.
Yeah, I know. I Dream of Jeannie, right?
Yeah. I'm saying, hang on, what?
Yeah, I think they have a hat somewhere that's got a first name hat and a last name hat of generic white person names.
Yeah.
And they just grab one from each and you end up with the same combination sometimes. But, it's not a bad little movie. It's a good drive-in flick, I think. The sort of thing people would have seen at drive-ins.
Yeah,
popcorns and hot dogs. And, the special effects, there are a couple of matte lines around a couple of pieces. But in general, the effect of him coming through walls and things like that and parts of his body being outlined by how far he is through the wall is done quite well. I think they really did bring their A game to that. The effects where people are touched by him and end up aging really suddenly were a bit primitive, but that too has a kind of charm to it, the fact that they thought, how can we put this in one shot? And they just did a still shot of the person and slowly painted over the still shot to have the age makeup.
Yeah, and even a couple of them, they don't always show the face. So there's one that you just see the hand that sort of suddenly goes whiter and all this sort of stuff. The rest is left to your imagination. So they were. I mean, obviously, partially for budget reasons, I assume, but it also gives that whole implied thing, which is, which is always a lot scarier when you think about it than what they can put on the screen.
Yeah, and the thing to remember with these films always, with any of this kind of stuff, is people were easier to scare in movies than they are now. Nobody had seen Saw or Postal or anything like that, any of those ones, or Hostel, sorry, or any of those kind of films. We've since been a bit desensitized to any kind of film violence, but at the time, given the fact that with the production code censorship and with the censorship that was very much on TV at the time, anything at all like this was about 20, 30 times as scary as we find it, if not infinitely more scary than we find it. So when you're watching these ones, you've always got to kind of keep that in mind just to realise where the movie's coming from.
Yeah.
So to wrap it up, would you recommend it or wouldn't you recommend it?
I'd certainly recommend it. It's an interesting piece of its. I don't think it dates badly. It's obviously of its time, but it's still an enjoyable film to watch.
It is, and one of the things is you can see them trying to aim for something. They were aiming for more character part in the movie, and they were aiming to have sophisticated special effects and to have slightly more adult relationships than the usual boy meets girl stuff, which is really, you got to give them points for at least trying to cater to grown-ups in doing that. And even though the film wasn't an enormous success, I think that it's one of those films that – I got a Facebook message from somebody who said that they'd seen the movie as a kid and didn't know the name of it. But when I put it up on Facebook, because you can link through YouTube on a Facebook, of course – and they were surprised because they'd only seen the movie years ago. They remembered it. That's the important thing. This person's like in their 40s at least now, and they remember from their childhood. So the movie does make an impact on people who see it at a formative age, which I found really interesting.
Yeah, certainly I think I probably wouldn't – I think anyone over about 13 or 14 – I wouldn't have any issues with them watching it at all, it's still got enough of a tension in there that it'd certainly have an impact on someone younger than that.
Yeah, and this is the kind of movie that I found scary when I was a little kid watching it on things like I'd watch Deadly Earnest, Awful Movies and that kind of stuff, which I had the good Deadly Earnest. We had the one in Sydney who looked like Michael Caine in the Ipcress file. There were Deadly Earnest in Adelaide and Brisbane and Melbourne and Sydney. And the one in Sydney looked like Michael Caine as a zombie, which is a lot cooler than anywhere else in Australia. We just kind of got lucky with that. But anyway, we're going to take another break now, and when we get back, I'm going to announce something like a competition, and then we'll get into Idiocracy, which is one of the sharpest social satires of the last 10 years. Okay, and we're back, and here's what I'm going to throw at people. It's not almost a competition, but it's not really. The Martian Drive-In podcast needs a logo and some graphics. I've tried to do it myself, and it came out looking like finger painting. So what I'm asking is, if people have ideas or if people would like to send something, now nobody's obligated to do this. This will be purely out of the generosity of your squidgy little heart. If anybody can knock up a logo, and maybe a graphic that we can use as a banner on the podcast website, here's what I'm going to do. If I get more than one, I will put them up on the podcast website, and I'll link to them on Facebook. And the voice of the people can say which one they prefer. Now, I don't want to make it a competition, I think. But here's the prize. I do have some Blu-rays and also DVDs, which are purchased copies. Unfortunately, I have watched them once, but I've got a box full of that kind of stuff. And what I was planning on doing is putting together a pack of that sort of thing and gifting them to whoever was generous like that. Now, you can send it to cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U at gmail.com. It's just a thought I had. It's just a way of trying to brand the podcast. And the other thing I was going to mention is that we're going to get our own RSS feed. It's not going to be linked on to the Paleo Cinema RSS feed in about a month or so. I'm going to create a brand new RSS feed, and I'm going to give people the option of only listen to The Martian Drive-In or only listen to Paleo Cinema. If you want to listen to both, you can subscribe to both feeds. So that's about it on that one, and let's get into Idiocracy. I'm just going to play the voiceover at the start of Idiocracy now, and then Paul and I will discuss why we like it.
As the 21st century began, human evolution was at a turning point. Natural selection, the process by which the strongest, the smartest, the fastest reproduced in greater numbers than the rest, a process which had once favored the noblest traits of man, now began to favor different traits. Most science fiction of the day predicted a future that was more civilized and more intelligent. But as time went on, things seemed to be heading in the opposite direction, a dumbing down. How did this happen? Evolution does not necessarily reward intelligence. With no natural predators to thin the herd, it began to simply reward those who reproduced the most and left the intelligent to become an endangered species.
Okay, so Idiocracy, Mike Judge. Like Mike Judge as a director and as a writer, he did, even though people don't particularly like it, he worked on, first one would have been Beavis and Butthead. I'm just trying to look through his IMDb here while I talk about that. He's got a long, hang on, let's have a look at him as a writer. Beavis and Butthead, King of the Hill, The Good Family, did some stuff for Saturday Night Live, and did a few movies, including one of our favourite films for Cubicle Jockeys, Office Space, from 1999. You've seen Office Space, haven't you, Paul?
Yes. Yep. Yeah, that one definitely worked, because at the time I was working, I was doing IT help desk. So, You know, not only had the Cubicle Jockey, but also had the computer things that they were sort of linking to.
Yep, and the problems with printers and faxes and all that sort of stuff. Office Space, really interesting, because the movie didn't do a lot. But what happened was it got a cult following. People really liked it. When it got a DVD release, it went really well on that. Even though it's got Jennifer Aniston in it, people liked the movie.
Beavis and Butthead is involved with King of the Hill, and I think Cleveland Show is another one that he's involved with.
He did Extract too, a movie with Jason Bateman in it, which was and had Mila Kunis in 2009. Wasn't as successful. I don't think it was as edgy as some of the other stuff he'd done.
Yeah.
But it's a kind of, you know, comedy of manners kind of thing. It's worth watching because it is Mark Judge's stuff, but I'm not sure whether it's his better work. But Idiocracy basically is his poison Valentine to the Fox News watching, gun-toting, redneck fuckwit generation in America. Did that cover it?
Yeah, yeah. It's a bit ironic to me that, you know, he's come out with something like Idiocracy because, you know, to me, you know, shows like Beavis and Butthead are part of the problem of the dumbing down of.
I think his was a satire of that kind of dumbing down stuff, but it's one of the problems you have with certain kinds of satire. It becomes part of the problem.
Yeah.
And that's unfortunate. If you're of a certain mindset, you can look at that stuff ironically and get what he's coming at with Beavis and Butthead and that kind of thing. But if you're a dumb teenager, Beavis and Butthead are role models.
Yes.
Kind of things. But I'll do a little bit of blurb about Idiocracy in spite of that little bit that went on before. The film tells the story of two ordinary people taken from into a top secret military hibernation experiment who awaken in a dystopia 500 years' time, wherein advertising, commercialism, and cultural anti-intellectualism run rampant, and dysgenic pressures has resulted in a uniformly stupid human society devoid of intellectual curiosity, social responsibility, and coherent notions of justice and human rights. This is from Wikipedia. Somebody with a university degree wrote that. Which I think there's a better one on IMDb. Just let me grab that one because I read that one earlier and I thought that's the one I want to use. And then, of course, when the time came, I read out the wrong one. Okay, let's have a look here. Director 13 Tiles, Idiocracy. Da, da, da. Again, an interesting little bit. Private Joe Bowers, the definition of the average American, is selected by the Pentagon to be a guinea pig for a top secret hibernation program. Forgotten, he awakes 500 years in the future. He discovers a society so incredibly dumbed down that he's easily the most intelligent person alive. And, yeah, this is a kind of, you know, poison pen letter to the way that Mark Judge sees America going.
Well, you know, you have to look at some of the things that, you know, especially with the education system in the US, you know, I read things every now and again, and it's their education is set by the local board rather than by a sort of a national standard.
Yeah, the Texas School Board gets to determine which textbooks are put out.
You know, there was something recently about, I think it was one of the Arizona schools that's you know, in part of the Bible Belt. And the actual textbook points to the Loch Ness Monster as being proof that evolution is a myth and that dinosaurs do indeed exist with men.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've been to Loch Ness and I didn't see a monster. I did see a military fighter jet flying low over the loch for some reason, and it didn't bomb anything. So I don't.
They're getting a nice straight run through there. So.
Well, yeah, it's a nice way to train them to do low-level flying. You just go down over the loch, you know, you come in just after Inverness and head down towards Fort William and do a little bit of a low-level thing there. And if you do happen to spot something, I suppose you're allowed to shoot it.
Well, you know.
Wouldn't that be great?
Wild haggis off the side, yeah.
Well, there's always a haggis shooting up in the Scottish Highlands from an aeroplane. That'd be cool. I'd actually pay money for that, but that's another issue. But yeah, this movie basically, it's not about a world of the future. It's about an America of the future. It is very specific to that one country.
It is very US centric, but yeah, I suppose that you know, there's no mention of what the rest of the world is like. So. You can sort of take that with a grain of salt.
Yeah, I mean, what's France like? What's Iraq like? I mean, it's just one of those things where it raises more questions than it answers. But the cast is kind of interesting. Luke Wilson, who's the more boring of the two Wilson brothers, plays Joe Bowers, and he plays it kind of generically too, but that's the role. He's got to be the average guy.
Yeah.
Not smart, not dumb, but right there in the middle. He's a bit thick because he doesn't realize that the other person in the experiment, Rita, played by Maya Rudolph, who people remember from Saturday Night Live, is a prostitute. She tells him she's an artist, and he believes her.
Yes.
And, so both of them end up being dumped. The reason they get uncovered is there's an enormous avalanche of garbage that's just been piled up. They've just got backed up the garbage trucks into the pile and turned this enormous Mount Everest of garbage into where they dump their stuff. And they get uncovered when the avalanche happens, and he gets knocked in through the apartment window of a guy called Frito Pendejo, played by Dax Shepard. Now, everybody in this movie in the future has a name that's hooked up to some kind of product, because Frito being kind of the corn chips, Pendejo is Mexican slang for little idiot, though in literal translation it means pubic hair. You got the president of the U.S. played by Terry Crews, and the president's name is Dwayne Elizondo Mountain Dew Herbert Camacho, which is a good name for a president. And there are other characters in there called Dr. Lexus, Hormel Chavez, Hormel are the people who make Spam, Beef Supreme is the guy who does the monster truck thing, and the judge played by Stephen Root. There's a little cameo with Stephen Root, the actor who played Milton in Office Space, playing a judge. Hank the Hangman BMW is his name.
Yes. The names are brilliant.
The names are brilliant, and he looks good in this too, because there he is playing a judge, total redneck moron, with a Wolverine haircut, which is a terrific little bit of character. And
I love this one, that sort of, because there's no preliminary character build-up. It's like, you know, you find this guy, Private Joe Bowers, who's stuck in the bottom of an archive with the army, and he quite likes it there. You know, he doesn't have to do anything too strenuous. It's not mentally taxing. It's not physically taxing. And that's about as far as you find out about him before he's thrown into this experiment. And so you get this sort of voiceover narration explaining to you how things have devolved. And there's a sort of a montage between the I'm trying to think what it starts out as is the Fuddruckers,
Fuddruckers, yeah,
company, and how that sort of how the name of the company evolves into, you know, something quite explicit, and with the different companies that are diversifying into other areas, and so, you know, by the time you end up in the future, Starbucks is now a brothel.
Yep, they give hand jobs at Starbucks.
And Costco is where you go for your education.
Yeah, the Costco is about the size of a small country.
Yes.
Which is kind of cool. And, you know, there is that. I mean, everybody's wearing T-shirts and clothing. All of the cloth printed has tons and tons of logos on it. So there's this kind of laminated logo on everyone's clothing. And, it is a nasty little satire in some ways, but it's also a really interesting one too. Then you get the problem. And, yeah, there are problems, of course. You have a world run by morons. They're going to do really moronic things. One of the things they do is they put energy drink on plants because the energy drink company told them that Brondo, the energy drink, is what plants crave.
It's got electrolytes.
Yeah, and nobody realizes that electrolytes are salt, and all of the soil's got salty because they keep putting energy drink onto the soil.
Brondo the Thirst Mutilator. It's like a monster truck you can pour into your face. It's got electrolytes. What are electrolytes? I don't know, but they're extremely awesome, and Brondo is full of them, and they help plants grow, which is why you should drink Brondo and not water, because water is from the toilet, and I've never seen plants grow out of a toilet. It's got caffeine, super extra caffeine, and 5 kinds of sugar, which makes it delicious, and much better than other energy drinks that are not delicious. Drinking it will make you wonder why you haven't ever crushed a human skull with your bare hands. But you won't have to, because you'll already know that Brondo tastes how that would feel, which is like having sex with a tractor trailer in a parking lot. I just split my pants like the Incredible Hulk! See that? Brondo will make you need new pants! And while you're out buying new pants, you should buy some new shoes, because you're gonna wear out your shoes from kicking everyone's ass all the time! Brondo will make you want to kick everyone's ass all the time! Which might be good or bad, but either way, you're gonna win! Because Brondo will make you win in things you're not even supposed to win at! Like yelling! Brondo will make you win at yelling! Or maybe instead of yelling, something else like jumping or waving! Because you'll be able to wave your hands really fast! And you'll probably become invisible, which doesn't even make any sense! But if that doesn't happen, then you'll probably just end up running somewhere! Which is good if you like running, but even if you don't, Brondo will make you win at exercise!
And, it's got some really nice other actors in it as well. You've got people like David Herman, who was in the first series of Mad TV. In there, you've got Justin Long, people know, playing a doctor in a little bit. Thomas Hayden Church turns up as the Brondo CEO. And, so basically, and the other thing we've really got to mention about this being a science fiction podcast, is the whole movie is stolen from source material elsewhere. The Marching Morons, a science fiction story written by Cyril M. Kornbluth. It's published in Galaxy magazine, 1951 now. I did my research on this because I downloaded a copy of it on my Kindle. And it does have a guy who's accidentally dumped into the future. In this case, what happens is he's gone into the dentist. He's got an experimental anesthetic drug. And the dentist drill shorts out in his mouth while he's under, and he falls into suspended animation. So they can't wake him up. They don't know how to wake him up. So they put him in a great big copper coffin, you know, chrome steel and copper coffin, and leave him at the university. Of course, universities, as the world becomes dumber over periods of time, aren't really useful places. And the world becomes balkanized into some very, very smart people who are an extreme minority and real big morons, basically, a world of morons. Things like they've got enormous cars with great big fins on the back and flames painted on the side, and the engines make enormous noises and smoke bellows out the back of them, and the speedo goes up to 250 miles an hour. But what they don't tell the morons is the cars only do about 100 kilometers an hour. So they all think they're going really, really fast because the engine noise is there and the car's rumbling and things like that. But they're basically overweight, dumb cars. And as this character in The Marching Morons goes on, he sees things like aeroplanes colliding in the sky and massive traffic accidents and things like that. Yeah. And he's much more of an asshole than the Joe Bowers character. He decides he's going to fix the problem for the world and convinces the smart people of the world, who basically are run off their feet trying to keep the world running. They've got to go to like 15 jobs, almost slaves to the morons. He decides that if they make him dictator of the world, he's going to fix their problem. And he does this by convincing the morons that Venus is a nice place, and that there's really cool holiday places on Venus. They build a shitload of rockets and launch them, not telling anybody among the morons that the rockets didn't work and they never got anywhere. So basically the rockets crush people with the acceleration and they get lost in space. So they decide they're going to build billions and millions of rockets and launch all the morons into space. Man, there's a twist at the end of it too. It's a very darkly satirical character about what Kornbluth saw as a dumbing down of America at the time.
Yeah, and that's back in the 50s, so yeah.
That's back in the 50s, yeah, and it got a lot dumber after that, of course. You know,
with this one, you know, there's enough with, there's examples of when he goes into the doctor's office, when he gets arrested, and things that, all of the machinery and the technology that's there is so self-automated that the people using it don't really understand. And I mean, you know, it's even further from black box technology than what we have now. That,
yeah,
you know, the people not only don't understand how it works, but are not even sure, you know, what it's supposed to do. And so it's like, well, you know, no, you're supposed to sit in the chair and that's how it works. And, you know, anything that is outside of, you know, anyone asking, but why, you know, that just sort of screws up so many things.
Yeah, anybody who's at all uses proper English or has any of a brain, they automatically accuse them of being a fag and gay and stuff like that, and make fun of them.
Pompous and faggy.
Yeah, and the problem with this film, why it didn't make a lot of money when it first came out, is it was made by 20th Century Fox, who also owns Fox News. They released it with no previews for the critics.
Well, apparently they did some test screenings, which were came back with abysmal results, and they didn't know how to market it, which, you know, I can perfectly understand. And so they sat on it for a year, and they're going, what the hell do we do with it? And then so they released it into a few small releases. They sort of skipped the big cities and just released it out into, you know, sort of half a dozen local releases, and then sort of quietly just got rid of it because they said, well, we've released it, so now we've done our job. See you later.
Yeah, so basically they screwed over the people who made the movie.
Yeah.
Which is a really unfortunate bit, because it is funny. There's a lot of good funny stuff in there, and it is harshly satirical of anti-intellectualism. I mean, the people of the future are dumb, but more than anything, the dumbness doesn't come from intellect in a sense. It comes from a culture that's actively anti-intellectual.
Well, I'm reminded, you know, when they get to the, you know, he's sentenced to one day of rehabilitation, and I was reminded of the, do you remember the ads for Mother?
Yeah, the energy drink.
Yeah, with the Mother World, and it was, you know, the bloke on the roller coaster with the flames coming out, and, you know, fried meat on a stick and all this sort of stuff. And I thought, yeah, well, you know, eventually it's like it's not about you end up with that whole monster truck, you know, my engine's bigger than your engine and I've got more flames on the side and
Bread and Circuses kind of stuff.
Yeah. What was the one where I suppose as an example of how much it picked up from word of mouth, I think 2010, someone approached Fox licensing to be able to use the Brondo name for the sports drink. Yep. And you can actually buy Brondo sports drink now.
That's cool.
So there's like a real life, you know, you can buy that. And, you know, some of the ads are as lame as you'd expect, but, you know, that's their tying into the Idiocracy marketing.
Yeah, that's the thing too. I mean, that's one of the problems Mike Judge has. People took Beavis and Butthead seriously when it was meant satirically, and now they're doing it with certain aspects of Idiocracy, which is really unfortunate because, you know, from what I've seen interviews with Mike Judge, and he's a smart guy, and he really does like making movies that take the piss. But, I mean, Fox would have been the perfect wrong studio to do this with, because they didn't really want to piss off part of their audience. There was an article in the New York Times that said explicitly that the reason they buried it wasn't that it was bad. Actually, they did some preview screenings in the UK, and it rated off the charts in the UK. But because of that active anti-intellectualism, which we're beginning to see with a few billionaires here in Australia who are trying it on for size, the dumber you make the population, the more you can get away with, and the more you can rip them off.
Yep.
And this is what Idiocracy says it leads to. The smart people don't breathe, the dumb ones do. The dumb ones have been pre-programmed to like spectacles and to not think about things at all and to criticize anything that's different. And that this is, you know, this movie is, even though it is stolen from the Corn Bluth Wholesale, this movie really is a kind of wake-up call sort of film on this. Even though we laugh at it, there's a serious side to it as well.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's an Isaac Asimov quote that's been going around. Obviously, it's been going around for years, but I've started seeing it more often, which is, I can't remember the exact quote, but it's something along the lines of, your ignorance doesn't outweigh my facts.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it's sort of, it's like, everyone's entitled to an opinion, but you know, you're not entitled to different facts.
Yeah, I'm kind of like Harlan Ellison's viewpoint, which is you're not entitled to an opinion, you're entitled to an informed opinion. If you don't do your homework, why should I listen to you?
Yeah, yeah. So, but, you know, yeah, as we've seen over here, you know, especially I think the climate change debate, you know, has got so many of the things that there are people who are willfully trying to say, well, you know, no, I'm going to commission a new study that'll say, you know, the polar ice caps aren't melting or something like that.
Yeah, and today's the day Australia gets its carbon tax, and the opposition was predicting all sorts of nasty things happening. Tony Abbott said that Whyalla in South Australia would be destroyed on the day a carbon tax came in, and people have been doing YouTube videos from Whyalla showing that nothing's changed.
It's still there.
It's still there. And a lot of those kind of things. And yeah, it's an active anti-intellectualism and an active perception that money's the only thing that matters. And I think that this movie, it's probably about 5 years, it came 5 years too early, I reckon. But this movie really does have something to say about that and shows you that if this goes on, and of course that's a great science fiction trope, if this continues, what will happen? And this movie is very much in the part of that. If the dumbing down of the world continues, what's the world going to be like?
And I think, you know, I've certainly, I don't know about its US popularity, but certainly within the people that I've spoken to here, a lot more people have become aware of this movie in the last 12 months locally. So,
I've got that too.
It's hit its peak of word of mouth here that, you know, people are starting to talk about it. It's like, oh, you should watch this.
Yeah, and I've got people on Facebook saying, why didn't I know about this movie beforehand? I mean, I've got friends on Facebook who watch Idiocracy and go, shit, why didn't people tell me about this film?
Yeah, and you know, and that's the thing. You know, it's been around for, 5 years now?
Six years.
It's only just starting to, hit word of mouth here.
Yeah, and then of course we're part of it now, but it really is. I think it's a important film. I'm not too comfortable with the fact that it stole the plot and the idea from an earlier work. I think there's way too much of that going on.
Arguably, you could say that it's, you know, it's the same trope.
Yeah, but there's a lot of plot similarities as well. Yeah. If people get a chance, you can get it for Kindle. It cost me like $3 to buy the short story and read through it. It's not a long read, but it's really interesting as well. And a lot of the things are in Idiocracy, like the stupid movies, and they have stupid radio as well in this one, called being the 1950s. It's all there and it's all borrowed, but I think the message is more important than the plagiarism in a sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, and that's what I said, it's one of the best, you know, science fiction movies of recent years for that reason, the fact that it does have something to say about here and now, which all good science fiction does.
Yes.
Mm.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And it's very much the, aside from the, You can watch it just for entertainment's sake, but yeah, there's certainly very much a social message that's right there, saying, you know, look, if we don't fix this, this is where we could end up.
Yeah, and I'm an optimist. I think the world can get better, but I think that to do it, there's a big fight ahead. I think there's a fight between the anti-intellectuals and the people who like the rule of reason, and I think that is coming to a head, and it's going to be interesting times we're going to live through in the next 20 or 30 years, where people will go, shit, yes, they were right about climate change, and shit, yes, we've really got to encourage science as a way out of it, because you can't retreat from technology. Nobody does that. Even the third world doesn't do that. Everybody wants a laptop and everybody wants an iPad and everyone wants mobile phones. If they can't get all of them, they'll get a mobile phone and start using it. Social networking in the third world is enormous. There are parts of Africa, Ghana, for instance,
yeah,
where mobile phone is the platform you have. And there were people writing their own apps for things and using even non-smartphones in new and creative ways to network amongst themselves.
But even I only saw it yesterday, I think. There was, there's this push to try and get more people into science, and because there's a lot of people that some will go into science and it's like, well, if I can do a certain thing that is covered by a private enterprise, I can go off there and earn more money. I can stay. It's like, you could do research with the CSIRO and get paid, minimum government wage or whatever, or you could go off to a professional pharmaceuticals company and get paid shitloads more. But once it goes into the pharmaceuticals company, that all gets under copyright and some patents and everything like that, whereas a lot of the CSIRO stuff, is research to find out, how things work or why things work.
Yeah, the patents.
Sorry, I was going to say there was a push. The European Union produced an ad for trying to get more women into science. And I posted a link on my Facebook of the ad. I'd actually found it on Boing Boing. I'm just looking at it and it's like, there are levels of epic fail that you sometimes see that are so, so big, you're just going, it leaves you speechless. And it's like the ad for this was, three teenage girls that looked like they were out of a Dolly magazine. And you just look at it, the whole ad just is a train wreck. And you're thinking, how on earth did anyone ever think that this would encourage women into science?
Yeah, there are ways to do it as well. And what we also need is in movies and media, we need more female role models who are cool and interesting to encourage that. Because the things that encourage a lot of the scientists we have now are cool people in science fiction movies and cool people playing scientists and astronauts and things like that.
There was an article in yesterday's paper talking about how stories like Harry Potter and The Hunger Games and stuff like that are encouraging younger readers to become more socially active because they want to be part of the change.
Yeah, then that's it. It comes in waves of generations. There are generations that are slack and there are generations that really realize that action needs to be taken about certain things.
Mm-hmm.
So, like I said, it's really interesting times we live in, and we really have to, even if you're just posting a Facebook update, you're part of the dialogue across the planet, and you're still fighting that war of ideas. These are the places where these battles are going on, online, in certain conferences, in the streets even, but on all of those platforms, we're fighting a weird kind of war at the moment, and I'm optimistic for it, but I think it's not going to be an easy process.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we should probably wrap it up there. We've been talking with our little chats in between for about an hour and 20 minutes now, which is about as long as I want to take it. I do want to say that we did get a little bit of feedback through Facebook. People like Douglas Waltz and a few other people have said that they really like The Martian Drive-In, but I need to get it in a format, if I can, that I can accumulate into proper feedback. So if you can send emails to kultguru@gmail.com, you can go to the voicemail, which I can't get up on the screen at the moment, but I will because I've got a new voicemail number, which is 206 is the area code, 203-3299. You can also email me MP3s if you've got a voicemail, and I'll pass any feedback on to Paul as well. And we really want to kind of make this podcast blossom. It's one of my great loves, as well as classic film, is in paleo cinema, and I really want to kind of have this one stand alone and have its own audience and have its own voice as well. So anyway, Paul, thank you for this, mate. I appreciate you. I did get you in a slightly short notice.
Well, thank you very much for having me on.
No, that's okay. Anytime, and we will get you back as well, because I'm going to have a rotating cast in a way. But we'll get there. I don't know what I'm going to be doing next on the podcast, but it will be interesting. So that's about it, people. Enjoy your movie watching. Watch the skies. Keep your powder dry. Don't let the morons drag you down. And I'll be back in a month with another Martian Driving podcast, and in 2 weeks with another Paleo Cinema. Bye.
Welcome to the Time Machine. We are going to take you back, first to the year 1939, when Charlie Chaplin and his evil Nazi regime enslaved Europe and tried to take over the world. But then an even greater force emerged, the Un, and the Un-Nazied the world forever.